History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they really don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it, to ask a few questions, to take the time to listen. And when we do that, we always come out ahead in the process. Our goal here is first and foremost to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as it turns out, we're not only educated, we're not only entertained, but we so often become truly inspired through these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to meet a member of that generation today in Bakersfield, California, where something very special is in the works. And who knows, maybe you can be a part of bringing it to completion. Our guest today is 96-year-old Walter Granger, a Navy veteran of World War II. As we're going to hear, his family has quite a legacy of service to our country.
Most of the time we start this program off by talking about a veteran's childhood during the Great Depression and all those memories, but I'm going to flip things around a little bit and let's talk about 2022, because it always encourages and inspires me when I see a World War II veteran who's still actively giving back to his community, and that's exactly what Walter Granger is doing in Bakersfield, California. So, Mr. Granger, tell me about this project that's going to come to a culmination on Veterans Day, November 11th, of this year. What's going to be happening here in your hometown?
We're going to be celebrating the lifetime of World War II veterans before they're all gone. Currently, we're having difficulty finding more than 18 that we could bring to the celebration. Maybe once a month, one more shows up somewhere. People don't take the paper anymore like they used to, and they don't watch the local news. And even though we've been on the front page of the local paper at least five times with pictures at some celebration or a fundraiser, we still go to, like I went to Lions Club in Button Willow the other day. We went to one of the local Rotary clubs, and there's just a ton of the people say, no, we really don't know anything about it. And it just really not only surprises us, but it worries us. So we always say, when you leave here, even whether you give us money or not, please tell your friends.
Well, and here's an opportunity. Here on all these radio stations, we get to tell that story, and a lot of people listen in your home area in Kern County. So this is going to be a lasting tribute, something that 100 years from now, people can come and see. What is this Kern County World War II Memorial going to look like? What's it going to capture? Can you describe for me the vision and the idea there?
The thing we're trying to do is to make it a little different. I say that it contains seven different elements. We're going to memorialize those 684 Kern County veterans who gave their last full measure, and we're going to put those on the front side of one of the six black granite slabs that are standing vertically across the back of the memorial. They're 4 feet wide and 6 feet high, 8 inches thick, and so they're very impressive. And across the front side will be engraved, and one of our members will be doing the engraving. On the other side, people are paying $250 to honor one of their relatives who served in the service and came home. So we're going to memorialize those that passed away. We're going to honor those. Most of those have passed away now, but they came home. Another element, just below the list of the 684, we're going to have two timelines, educational timelines, that show the main events from the beginning of the war to the end of the war for the Pacific Theater. And we're going to do that with etchings, and then below that there will be a text to describe that. Immediately under that is another timeline just for the European theater to do this very same thing. And that's really a challenge to find good pictures that can be engraved and then to verify exactly what's happening. I'm scared to death that we're going to say something about some activity that somebody's going to say, well, that isn't right. And so we're not looking at one source. We're looking at several sources. And hopefully we'll accomplish that. One of the big problems is we're trying to do things that affect locally. We want to make sure that those are in there. Like, for example, when the Japanese Americans were hauled off in the middle of the night with their belongings in a suitcase, they were hauled off down to L.A. and then moved on a train to Poston, Arizona. That was in the spring of 1942, and they didn't come back until, and we don't know if they all came back, but came back in 1945. And to get the exact information, how many left and all that kind of thing, because I saw them disappear, the kids on the track team. And the people in your class, they just disappeared. And they never really talked much about it. Right in across to the front of the memorial will be four pedestals, which will depict those people and those activities that were active at the home front that kept the thing going. We kind of made the impression locally about that when we had a USO show at the local dinner theater, which came off really great. Full house, lots of people, lots of good food, lots of stories. We're having lots of fundraisers. And in the center between the six labs and the four pedestals, we're going to have a life-size mother or wife, however you look at it, standing on a five-foot pedestal, life-size. She's holding her toddler with one arm. She's leaning over like she's in agony and in throes of tears. There's tears running down her cheek. In her right hand, she's holding the dreaded Western Union telegram. The War Department regrets to inform you. So many people got that. Around the border will be a slanted portion because the base of the memorial is raised 2 feet, and so there's an angled portion around the edge, and there will be bronze-looking plaques, one-size plaque, for those people who give $10,000 in cash or in-kind donations. We're getting a lot of our money is from contractors who are doing in-kind work. There will be a larger plaque then for those that give $15,000. And then there will be separate ones for those major ones like Klassen Corporation that's been with us for 2 years working on all the details. There will be plaques for them. And then around the perimeter, we have six granite benches, 2 feet wide, 6 feet long. And for $25,000, you can have your company or your name in bold letters and an insignia of your company. $25,000 for one side, $50,000 for both sides. And every time we say that, people giggle. Because the people that we're talking to, in most cases, won't be given $50,000. Oh, and I should give Benjamin Victor a plug on the statue. One of the gals persisted and just a few months ago got a hold of Benjamin Victor. He's a local guy, born in Taft, moved to Bakersfield, graduated from Foothill High School, and now is an internationally known sculptor. He's the only person, the only sculptor, who has three sculptors in the Hall of Statues at Washington, D.C., and he's working on the fourth one while he's working on our lady. We've done a lot of Zoom meetings with him. He's a great guy, just a great guy, and that'll be a big draw. And I'm constantly saying, we got to remember, it isn't a Benjamin Victor memorial, because that's going to be a big draw. It's for the World War II veterans.
And you've given us kind of the picture of how the memorial is going to be structured and the different elements of it. But there were a lot of different concepts for that as you guys as a committee kind of worked through this to come up with the ultimate design that now is going to be reality on November 11th when it's unveiled with a parade through Bakersfield and as many World War II veterans as you can find on hand. Whose concept was that you just described and laid out? Where did that come from?
It was mine. I gave a big pitch about the kind of thing that I just said, that try to make it different. Like, for example, the timeline. You won't find very many memorials with timelines on them. You won't find very many memorials, actually, that have the contributors. I've worked on more than one memorial, not necessarily a veterans memorial, but a memorial, and 99% of the time when you're donating money to build the structure and want to honor someone, it's been a brick that you walk around on. And in one situation, trucks actually drove over them and broke them. And so we wanted to get away from that concept. And one of the other fellas, I didn't come up with that idea, to have the big slabs like they are, and on one side have the memorializing and on the other side have the honoring. And it's worked out very well. My family received a telegram. My brother, one of my brothers, was not killed in action, but he never came home. He got sick and died. And so he's not memorialized, but there's going to be five Granger boys who were in World War II who are honored on the backside.
And that's what strikes me as I hear you describe this, is that you feel the need for each one of these elements. The need to honor the 684 from Kern County who died, the need to recognize other veterans who served, the home front, and that statue that you described of the mother holding a child receiving the telegram. I'm sure that's going to be an emotional sight for a lot of people who visit it. November 11th is when this is all going to be unveiled with that parade and all that, but there's still some work to be done in paying for it. Well, what do you expect the total price tag on this project to be?
$500,000.
And how much does your committee still need to make this a reality?
A little less than $200,000.
And if somebody's listening to this and they want to help to make sure that this happens on time on November 11th, which isn't too far away, what can they do? What's the best way for them to contribute?
You can go online to Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial. When it pops up, the girls have done a nice job. You know, it's a big job to put up a website, and it's almost a bigger job to keep it up to date. It's like anything else. The minute you put it up, everybody starts criticizing. How come you got this there? How much you got? Why? What are you doing? But there's a spot there where you can click on it. I'm not a big tech guy at all. I'm a little tech guy, but you're supposed to be able to punch on that and different ways to pay. We enjoy going out and talking to service clubs. One of the things we carry with us is the paperwork. We have a real nicely done trifold that tells the kind of things that I just talked about, and we have flatware, and we've had the opportunity to have a lot of fundraisers. So the paperwork is out there, and we just need people to give us what they can and to tell everybody else what it's going to be, where it's going to be, and we need your help.
Well, and I know our listeners, and they're all over the place. They're in different states around the country and even some from overseas. And they're generous people, and this is going to touch some hearts, and they're going to step up and help you. So now we know what it's all about and what you need to complete it. I'm going to circle back around later and ask you what you hope people are going to get, you know, years down the road when they visit that, what they're going to get from the experience, so you can be thinking about that. But I want to hear your story, because you've given us some hints along the way, and there's some of that memorial and your concept for it, which is going to become reality, that touches different aspects of your own experience. So tell me about your family growing up. You were born right here in Bakersfield 96 years ago, right?
Downtown Hospital, Mercy Hospital. My family came here in 24. My dad was an oil worker. He worked the circuits around Kern County and ended up at the pumping plant here in Oildale. There was six of us rambunctious boys. We all graduated from Standard School in Oildale. We all graduated from Kern County Union High School. Well, that's not true. The five oldest graduated from Kern County Union High School. In 1945, midterm, the Board of Trustees changed the name to Bakersfield High School because we were starting to grow. So the baby graduated from Bakersfield High School. The older five boys, the oldest, was drafted when the war started, and the rest of us joined as we got old enough to do that. The second brother passed away. He was not killed in action, but he passed away. Dad put a gold star in the window, even though he wasn't killed in action. And the rest of us served in the Pacific. The oldest boy in the Army served in the European theater, and the rest of us served in the Pacific. All aboard ship, we're all in the service until the war ended. I always tell the story, it's really funny. to watch the commercials to join the service, and they talk about all the things you can do and all the schools you can go to, and it's just going to be wonderful. And when I signed up and got on the bus at the Southern Hotel in Bakersfield and drove down to Union Station and got on a train and went down to San Diego Training Center, there wasn't any question but I was going to be in the Amphibious Corps, because everybody who walked through the gate ended up with an Amphibious Corps badge on their shoulder. I never set foot in a landing craft for practice or anything until I got on board of a brand new ship. We ran a test run up and down the coast of California to make sure we could make it to Pearl Harbor, make it to Hawaii. When they decided that we probably could make it, why, it was an attack, a brand new kind of a ship, attack personnel, APA, amphibious. And we got to Hawaii, unloaded the boats, the Higgins boats, and started learning something about them. And I've been asked, well, didn't you see a video about them or what to do? And I said, no video. We got in the boat and invaded the backside of Oahu several dozen times until we found out, I guess we could have made the video that they used later or something.
And let me stop you there, because it's time for our first break. And I also want to rewind a little with you and hear about the years leading up to your assignment to that APA, the USS Crenshaw. Much more to come with 96-year-old Walter Granger of Bakersfield, California. Go to hometownheroesradio.com for links to the Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial. Maybe you would like to help make Mr. Granger's dream a reality by this November. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 96-year-old Walter Granger of Bakersfield, California. Perhaps he was your shop teacher if you grew up in Kern County, where he's lived his entire life, except for the 2 years Uncle Sam had him crisscrossing the Pacific on the USS Crenshaw during World War II. We heard about Mr. Granger's vision for the Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial, which will be unveiled this coming Veterans Day, November 11th. He and the rest of that volunteer team are still raising funds to complete the memorial, and I have a link up for you at hometownheroesradio.com if you would like to contribute. I know you enlisted in the Navy at age 17 in 1944, but I want to hear a little more about the years leading up to that. You're one of six children in your family, right?
Six boys. Everybody said Dad must have wanted a girl.
Kept trying, but ended up with six boys. So that had to be interesting, growing up around the oil fields in Kern County with five brothers. And you're number five out of six, is that right?
Five, correct.
So what was that childhood like? I mean, these are the Depression years, but you're here in oil country and you got big brothers beating you up and a little brother that maybe you can get the upper hand on. What were the things that dotted your memories from those years?
Well, you never had to worry about what you were going to wear the next year because your older brother had it on and you were going to wear. Dad was really good about, He had all the equipment to repair shoes, you know, the hammers and the nails and the glue and all that. Quite often you knew the shoe was going to be fixed up and Dad would always polish it so it kind of looked new. And Mom was real good with the needle and thread and the sewing machine. But people said it was tough. I guess it was tough. Thank goodness for credit at the grocery store. It was one of those deals where you knew personally the whole family at the grocery store. You knew the whole family at the drug store. We all went to the same doctor. Now you look back on it and you think, well, it was really tough, but there was always food on the table and clothes to wear, and we were always clean. I knew that come Sunday we'd all be in church.
And how'd you get along with those brothers?
We got along very well. My dad was a fabulous husband, fabulous father. My mom was a fabulous mother, a fabulous wife. They showed the way, and we all came out all right.
And I like to ask this question of any of the veterans I meet, because sometimes there's something there, sometimes there's not so much, but it's always fascinating to me how we make plans for our lives, and then life happens. And sometimes somebody else has a plan for our life that's better than the one we had for ourselves. And I'm just curious for you, did you have some of those boyhood dreams or ambitions, you know, when you're running around with your brothers daydreaming that, hey, someday this is what I'm going to do or who I'm going to be?
Early on, I wanted to be a history teacher. I don't know if it was because the history teacher was so great at Standard. All the teachers were great at Standard. All the administrators were great at Standard. And when I got to high school, all the teachers were great. The history teacher was a personal friend. That may have had something to do with it, but I planned on being a history teacher. After the war, I got to thinking about it. I'm not necessarily an outdoor guy. We never were campers or anything like that. But I got to thinking about being in a classroom all day long. That just didn't sit well with me. So I thought, well, you know, if I was a shop teacher, regardless of the shop, I was close to being outdoors. And I ended up in the auto shop where half of the kids were out on the apron working. And so it worked out great. I ended up teaching a little bit of each. You know, when you teach classes like that, especially when I started out at Shafter, I taught auto, metal, wood, drafting. I was the audiovisual guy because I could pick up the movies in town. I lived in town and drove to Shafter every day. The girls, whenever they wanted to have a fancy dance or something, my kids and I did all the preparation, so you were involved in everything. It's been a wonderful life. I'm a lucky guy.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that there are some of your former students listening to this right now, and I'm sure hearing your voice is putting a smile on their face. And, you know, you mentioned your oldest brother getting drafted right after the war started. But I'm interested in that. You know, the start of the war, Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how you found out about that, where you were and how that unfolded?
We were getting ready for church. My dad and the older boys had built a big sleeping porch on the back of the house, so that all of us kids were in the back getting ready for church. And it came over the radio, and we said, oh my gosh. And then naturally, you know, everybody at church said, what's going to happen? And we heard FDR on the radio, and that was it.
And you were 15 at the time, still in high school. And you alluded to this a little earlier when you talked about the Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial that you guys are working on. It's going to be ready here in November. That there will be part of that memorial dedicated to the Japanese-American families here in Kern County whose lives were so severely changed. And so you saw the effects of that in the months that followed there at your high school?
Yes, and it was just kind of a shock, you know.
I mean, these are your classmates. These are kids, most of them born in America, that you've been going to school with, and now all of a sudden they're being taken away. Do you remember what that was like as a 15-year-old trying to wrap your brain around?
Well, and not knowing, just like there were several on the track team. I was on the track team for 4 years, and they were friends. And in your various classes, saw some of them at church. They eventually had their own Methodist church, Japanese Methodist church. Our community at that time, all the churches did things together. We had sport clubs and contests, and then they're gone. And you don't know anything about it.
Did you ever, you know, after the war, have a chance to see any of them again, some of your track teammates or the Japanese-Americans you'd known?
No, never did. Never did.
You mentioned also that the second of the six boys in your family passed away during the war. What can you tell me about that, how that happened, when that happened, and where were you? Because that couldn't have been easy for you.
The way I found out, first of all, we knew that he was very healthy all of his life. So when we heard that he was not well, we were all surprised. The way we found out, it was in July, and my folks like to go to the Long Beach area. So they and the baby were off on vacation, and I was home alone. And a taxi cab drove up in front. The guy rang the bell, and I thought, what in the world is this all about? He must be lost and wants some direction. And he handed me the telegram and turned away. And I opened it, and it said, sorry to inform you that your son, Edwin, has passed away at Sawtelle Hospital. And I thought, holy Toledo, what am I going to do? I don't even know where my folks are. They're down in the Long Beach area. So I tried to think of a place where they had been before, and I could then I had to find a phone number, and I found a phone number of a couple of places where they had, I thought they had stayed before, and left my number and called me ASAP, and then waited, and finally, I don't know, I have no recollection of how long it was, but it wasn't the same day. Dad called and said, what's happening? And in between that time, I got a phone call that they wanted the folks to come by to figure out what to do to the Sawtelle Hospital. And it ended up that the folks went there and decided to bury him there in the Sawtelle Cemetery across the street from the Sawtelle Hospital. Naturally, we all went down there to the service, and it was kind of a dingy area, but they felt like that was the thing to do. There was a veteran section there. Subsequent to that, as we've gone back, they still didn't do very much, but what, you know, what are you going to do? And then when they put the National Cemetery here, I thought, well, the thing to do is to go back down there and talk to them and find out about moving him up here. Well, in the interim, in the 70s, the U.S. government took over the Sawtelle Cemetery and now called it the Los Angeles National Cemetery. It looks like a miniature Arlington. It's just beautiful. And we went down, and they were just setting up all the digital information so anybody could find out who's there and where they are. One gal was super nice. She told us how to get there, and one of the guys said, well, don't tell them how to get there. I'm going to take them over there. And we went over, and the dingy area was no longer dingy. It was really nice. So we came back, and we drove through, and it was just a magical transformation. It was just beautiful. And so I told the gal, I said, well, we're going to go home and talk about it. And I said, can I hug you? And she said, I've never been hugged by a World War II veteran before. And I said, thank you so much. They were so gracious.
Yeah, that's right off the 405 freeway there in West L.A. It's a beautiful spot to visit, and more special for someone who's got a personal connection like you do. And I can't imagine what that must be like as a teenager to get that telegram and then to be the one responsible for informing your parents. What were you able to find out about what happened to him and how he got sick and why it took that turn?
Well, they said he had rheumatic fever, and had evidently the connection between rheumatic fever as a rheumatic heart. In those days, they evidently didn't know much about it. And still to this day, you don't hear much about a rheumatic heart or rheumatic fever.
And he had been serving in the Navy?
Yes, he was in the Navy. He and number three was at Berkeley and became a 90-day wonder. And number four, and he and another friend, they all joined together at the same time. Do you know what a 90-day wonder is?
Absolutely. Usually it's used with a bit of a pejorative sense from those who had to serve under the 90-day wonders, huh? They became officers in that time.
Yeah, well, right. They made them an ensign right away. The worst part was that some of them thought that they were war-experienced seamen and did not hit it off at all with the crew. But we had a couple 90-day wonders aboard, and they were fabulous kids, just like I'm sure my older brother was, that they fit right in. They didn't try to put anything upon the regular men that had been in the Navy for years. So it was a big joke.
And as far as Edwin's story, what was the ship that he was on?
He never got on a ship, Edwin.
Because he got sick before he could be assigned?
Correct.
There's a project right now that I've talked about a few times on this program that's called Stories Behind the Stars. When they say the stars, they mean all those gold stars in Washington, D.C. at the National World War II Memorial, which you've been to, that represent well over 400,000 Americans who died during World War II while serving in the armed forces. And it wasn't necessarily that they died in action, but they died. And so you're telling us one of those stories behind the stars in your older brother, Edwin. Have you ever thought, in all these years since, what his life might have turned into? What he would have been like if he'd had the opportunities that you and your other brothers had?
Oh, definitely, because he was very mechanically inclined. He would have had a business somewhere. As we grew up, all the kids had old cars. If the folks changed cars, well, then the 1926 Essex Terraplane that the folks had became our car. We were the terror of Oildale, climbing the hills. There was enough kids to put some more weight on the back of the car, and we could out-climb lots of cars that looked like they were better than we were, but that old Essex really climbed those hills in North Oildale.
And here, you've lost a brother. You've got three other older brothers who were in the war. What made you say, hey, I want to sign up? I want to go in the Navy before they draft me.
Well, there wasn't any second thought. Dad was in the Navy in World War I. The emphasis, naturally, then was one for the Navy, all for the Navy. The baby was in the Navy in the Korean War. So there was all six boys served in the Navy in wartime. I've often said I'm one of seven Granger boys who served during wartime in the armed forces and proud of it.
So that's your dad and his six sons.
Correct, yeah. My folks were very patriotic, had flags all the time. Matter of fact, my mother's immigrant parents, German, named her Alice Liberty Jensen because she was born on the 4th of July.
We're learning quite a bit about Walter Granger and his family, but we're not done yet. Again, if you'd like to support this World War II veteran's mission to honor his fellow vets, and especially the fallen, with this new World War II Veterans Memorial in Bakersfield, California, go to hometownheroesradio.com. I also have the memorial's website linked for you on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we're going to hear some of Mr. Granger's World War II Navy memories when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with one of the most youthful and energetic 96-year-olds you're going to find anywhere. You can find Walter Granger these days weaving his way through his native Kern County in California to raise support for a World War II Veterans Memorial that's going to be unveiled this coming November. You can find all that information online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Back in 1944, he was just 17 when he said goodbye to his sweetheart Joan and enlisted in the Navy. Did you have any idea what you were getting into?
Not at all. I actually had never talked with the brothers who were in the Navy. Never really talked with Harold in the Army. And the only thing we did believe that the war had to be just about over, because if you were watching at all, you could see that the Japanese were being driven out wherever they were. And but again, that wasn't central in your thinking, you know. It's just here we go, what can I do, where are they going to send me? And then to be kind of just put into the job that I ended up, I never was a boatsman. We never had a boat. I had friends who had a boat. We went out to Lake Ming and rode in the boat, that kind of thing. And then all of a sudden, well, here I am with the responsibility of loading 2 to 3 dozen guys in a boat and taking them ashore. And with no preemptive training, you know, here you go. You learn. It was like learning how to drive without your mom or dad helping you, you know. It just rolled with the punches, and they send you out and expect you to know what you're doing. I was fortunate from the standpoint that as we were assigned after we became experts taking over Oahu, they figured we were ready to go and they needed help in the Philippines to finish off the Philippines. They loaded us up with gyrenes and sent us to the Philippines, and we were all ready to do our part. And we got to the Philippines and they said, well, we've got everything under control, so you need to refuel and restock, but we need you in Okinawa. And that's a long stretch from Philippines to Okinawa. So by the time we got there, they said, well, we've just about got this thing cinched, so just stand by. Now, they were still bombing at night, but Okinawa was taken over. There was no fighting on the island. It was one of those, you know, every place you berthed, whether it was Pearl Harbor or wherever, because we stopped at a lot of little islands for R&R, and you wanted to make sure, the captain made sure that he wasn't berthed next to a cruiser or a battleship or a aircraft carrier, because as much smoke as we put out, part of our job was to take the Higgins boats and smoke up the area and then try to get back to your ship. That was a challenge. And you knew that sticking up out of the smoke was a bunch of antennae. And so that's all the Japanese could see. So they would bomb that area. They didn't bomb in the daytime, but they still bombed at night into August. And then August the 15th, I was on duty, and they announced the war's over. Everybody yelled and cried and wondered if it really was. throughout the world, just because somebody said the war is over, everybody didn't know that. And you hear the stories years and years later where they run across somebody and they're still fight the war because they had no idea it was over. I don't remember how long it was, but a few days later, why, there was this huge armada of our planes that flew over, headed for Tokyo Bay to sign the surrender. And we were all of us that signed up for the duration. One of the first things they ask you when you signed up was, now let's get this straight. Do you want to sign up for the regular Navy or do you want to sign up for the duration? Well, 99% of us said, well, the duration, because it didn't look like it was going to be more than a year or two. So you hear it over the loudspeaker, the war is over. So you know what that means. We're going home. Well, I went home a year later. Went home a year later.
And I want to hear what you did for that year, but I want to make sure I understand this clearly too, because I'm guessing, given the nature of what you did as a coxswain on a Higgins boat, an LCVP, what you were prepared to do at the Philippines and Okinawa was take trips to shore, maybe take troops to shore. If there had been an invasion of mainland Japan, do you think you would have been taking boats full of Marines ashore?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we were in that position. As it ended up, and the one thing I wanted to mention, one of the things people don't understand about an invasion, you have a couple of dozen transport ships, all with Marines on them, ready to make a landing. You lower your boat, your Higgins boat, in the water, and most of them were the light. Higgins boat was made out of plywood with a tin covering for protection. And then they had the bigger ones that would carry more machinery and more men, but they were usually just for the machinery because they were bigger. And then the job is to hold your boat next to the ship with a rope ladder that's dropped over, and the Marines have to come down fully loaded with all kinds of gear, stepping on other fingers and what have you. And the boat is up and down and up and down and in and out. And they get on the boat and you push off, and then you go out to a reconnoitering area and you go round and round and round and up and down and all around. And everybody's waiting for everybody to get lined up. And during that time, quite a few of the guys are at the gunwale, throwing up over the edge. The smoke, the diesel smoke from the diesel engine, and the smell of the life jackets is just unbearable. And then they're an endless time, round and round and up and down. And so there's a ton of them, the guys. And then you try to catch a wave like a surfer so you'll get up to the beach. You've seen the pictures where they drop the front gate and the guys step off into 5-6 feet of water, fully loaded. And then many of the beaches, they've got all the metal spikes in the way that the Axis has put in the water to stop you. So it isn't getting the boat and go ashore. It's a lot more to that, and I'm not sure that everybody understands that. That's a huge problem. And then People who have never taken a small boat into the beach, then try to get out. You got to back out without broaching the boat, because once you start losing it, you're not going to turn around and drive this boat into the waves. So it's quite a talent to get that boat out straight without losing the boat.
And you said when you got news that the war was over, you thought, okay, we get to go home. But it was another year. So what were you doing for that year?
They decided that they needed somebody to take back some of the property that had been taken by the Japanese. You know, when the Japanese came down, the Japanese started in 1935 in Manchuria, coming down the Pacific, and they didn't come marching down 5 miles wide. They came down and hit the main seaports. And so then the object was to go backwards. So they directed us to go to Shanghai and pick up a load of Chinese troops and reoccupy. And by the time we got to, before we got to Shanghai, they redirected us to Hong Kong. So we went farther south and actually went to Kowloon, which is one of the islands there off of Hong Kong. We loaded up with Chinese troops and then hit the major cities, ports, all the way up to Peking, and dropped off a few soldiers at each spot to move in and tell the people, yes, it's true, the war's over. And when we finished that, we went back to Okinawa and loaded up with gyrenes and took them to Korea, dropped them off at Incheon. And that was an interesting deal that nobody told us. I don't think we should have known. The tide was a 20-foot tide. Ooh. And some of the guys who didn't follow orders real well left their boats and went ashore and stayed ashore. And when they came back, their boats were mudded in, immovable until the tide came back in. So that was an interesting experience for them. And after that, then we unloaded them at Korea, and we were directed to Nagoya, Japan, and we picked up a load of Marines who had occupied southern Japan and took them home to Bremerton, Washington, where our ship was decommissioned and we were given our discharge. And the last people we saw as we went out the last hallway was a big sign, re-enlist. And they said, here we go, come on over here, fellas. It was like a hawker at a carnival. This is the place to sign up. And we all just kind of laughed and went off. And I hitchhiked home, and that was it.
You taught here in Kern County at Shafter High and North High for 3.5 decades. Like I said, a lot of your former teachers or former students are listening, I'm sure. You got to enjoy 68 years of marriage with Joan and raise your family. And now here you are, 96, and you already told us all the stuff you're working on. Maybe you get asked this a lot. What's your secret? Because it says you're 96, but it doesn't seem like you're acting 96.
Well, I'm a lucky guy. I have good genes. Mom and Dad were healthy. They only lived to 87, but they were healthy. If you have a bride like I did, and you have a daughter like I do, and you work a lot, and you go to church every Sunday, I'm a lucky guy.
Well, and you're building something pretty special right now in the Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial. I don't want to forget to ask you, though, about your trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Kern County to see the National World War II Memorial and other sites that I'm sure were meaningful to you. Was there something in that experience, that journey with fellow veterans and volunteers, that was most meaningful to you?
Well, it was just one tearjerker after the next. I was fortunate. The fifth grade at Thorner Elementary collected the money, cookie sales, and the parents and the kids of the whole school put $1,500 together to pay my way. Oh, I had a fabulous weekend. Every place we went, there was hundreds and thousands of people yelling and screaming congratulations, and kids who could hardly walk, to people with canes.
What did you think about at that memorial when you looked at that wall of gold stars that represents over 400,000 Americans in World War II who didn't get to come home?
When they tell you how many that represents, it really brings it home. It isn't just a number. I mean, it's a field. What are they, 6-8 feet high for a half an acre out there? And that's why we're trying to have some stars at the top of each of the black granite slabs. There's going to be a medallion for each service. And in the center of that medallion is going to be a gold star. So we want to pick up the same feeling.
And I promised you I was going to ask you this, because this memorial will be unveiled on Veterans Day, November 11th, as long as people get it done and you still need some money to finish it. And I hope people listening will chip in and they can look at hometownheroesradio.com for a link to how to do that. A year from now, 10 years from now, 50 years from now, when someone comes through Bakersfield and they drive down the Avenue of Heroes and they come to this Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial, what do you want them to experience? What do you want them to come away with?
I want them to have the feeling that they're very fortunate that all this had to happen. It had to happen because we had to protect our freedom. We had to go. We've never gone somewhere to conquer. We've only gone there to keep people from coming here to conquer us. We've always gone to help somebody else who's trying to be conquered. And to recognize the fact that just from Kern County, there are 684, that included one woman, and the one woman was married to another person who was killed. They weren't together. They were in different places, but they were man and wife. And the fact that it could happen again, particularly if we don't straighten out and realize what a democracy is and how it can work. Everything is so politicized, it's just criminal.
So I just have one more question for you. If there's anything else that you want to add, feel free. And I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country in World War II. And thank you for the way you're serving your community and your fellow veterans now. I know a lot of people are touched by that. When you think back over everything that's happened in your 96 years, and I realize you're still looking forward, especially to November 11th and the unveiling of this monument. But when you look back over your life, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Family, my family. My family has been my life. I'm just one lucky guy.
Walter Granger, 96 years young. And isn't it clear that part of what keeps him so young is the purpose that propels him? I'm going to say it one last time. If you would like to support his efforts and help make this unique World War II Veterans Memorial in Bakersfield, California, reach completion in time for Veterans Day this November, go over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You're also going to find some photos and a short video with Mr. Granger there, as well as the extended podcast version of this episode with a few more of Mr. Granger's thoughts that wouldn't quite fit into our radio time. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.